I think it's a myth that Vail Resorts wants to come in and just change the way that we are going to do things. I really tell anybody that will listen that the decisions that we make are made right here on the ground. And I can tell you that if we do something right, it's because of a decision that we made. And if we do something that maybe wasn't right, it's a decision that we made.
Welcome to the storm. I'm your host, Stuart Winchester, going to the epicenter of New England and Northeast skiing today, and one of my very favorite places in the entire world, the state of Vermont. We'll get right there. First, a huge thank you to all of my paid subscribers to the Storm Skiing Journal and podcast. You are listening to this episode 7 full days before free subscribers. Look, I cannot tell you how much I appreciate your support of the Storm and of independent ski journalism. Free subscribers, I appreciate you as well. If you like the Storm, you will love the paid tier, mostly because it includes a lot more content than what you're getting right now. I know ski season is winding down for most of you, but if you want to keep the wintertime energy going, I am publishing year-round, and I guarantee a minimum of 100 articles every single year. And these are not just short social media style missives. I am putting out some of the most comprehensive analysis of the lift-served skiing world that you will find anywhere. You can upgrade anytime at stormskiing.com. If you're new here, welcome. I want you to know that the podcast is just a small part of the Storm, and there is a lot more waiting for you when you sign up for the free or paid tiers of the Storm Skiing newsletter at stormskiing.com. You can also follow the Storm on the X platform or Instagram at Storm Ski Journal. All right, a quick word from my incredible partner, Hotronix Ski Boot Foot Warmers and Heated Socks. It may be spring, but my feet are still cold. My feet are always cold. Well, they used to be. They're not anymore. I solved that problem by hooking myself up with Hotronix XLPC foot warmers in my ski boots. If you've had Hotronix before, you should know that the updated C series is the very best on the market. With a new, larger anatomical shape, but with smaller, lighter batteries that perform in temperatures down to 22 degrees below zero, which, hey, Okemo skiers, that sound familiar? Or if you're looking for a less intrusive solution, consider Hotronix XLP heated socks. These socks offer the best size to capacity ratio and longevity on the market, with up to 18 hours of continuous heating power, and they will fit into your existing ski boots without issue. And here's an awesome feature. I love this. This new generation of Hotronix products is Bluetooth enabled, meaning you can manage them from the Hotronix Heat app. Look, it is time to ditch the tough guy mentality. Skiing should not be an exercise managing discomfort. Hook yourself up with Hotronix boot warmers or heated socks this ski season. Click the link in the banner on the podcast article to get started. Episode 166, Bruce Schmidt, President and General Manager of Okemo Mountain, Vermont. New England skiers, you know that Vermont is a big, bad ski state, full of big, bad ski areas. Jay Peak, Smuggler's Notch, Stowe, Mad River Glen, Sugar Bush, Killington, these are all sprawling ski centers that will give you everything you can handle on the hill. But not everyone's looking for that, are they? And when you're toting your family out for a long weekend on the bump, sometimes you want a big, not-so-bad ski area. And that is Okemo. The place is enormous, with more than 120 largely gentle trails and high-speed lifts flying all over the place. There is some steep stuff. There's some glades, bumps here and there, but none of that terrain is what defines the place. What defines Okemo is it is a big, fun hill that's appropriate for just about anyone. And no one knows this big old mountain and its quirky history better than my guest today, who's been working there in one capacity or another since before many of you were born. Let's hear it. My guest today is the Vice President and General Manager of Okemo Mountain Resort in Vermont. He also oversees Mount Sunapee and Cratchit ski areas in New Hampshire. with 20 lifts, serving a 2,200-foot vertical drop across 632 acres. Okemo is Vail Resort's second largest U.S. mountain east of the Rockies. Aside from 1 year at Mount Sunapee, he has worked at Okemo since 1987. Bruce Schmidt is my guest. Bruce, a huge welcome to the storm to you. I am so fired up to talk about this very important mountain in this very important ski state. How is everything up in Vermont today, Bruce?
Well, I can't thank you enough for having me on your podcast. It's going to be a pleasure chatting with you today. You know, things are going pretty well. It's been a great season so far. The team has been working so hard. Had a lot of events going on here at Okemo. We had a 90s weekend last weekend. We got Let It Glow party with ice sculptures, Torchlight Parade coming up in another week, and getting ready for the Slush Cup as we head into the spring. So yeah, it's been a good season.
So for listeners, we're recording this on February 27th, which happens to be the Tuesday after the President's Week, which traditionally in the Northeast and in New England is the busiest week of the year. How did that week go for you, Bruce? How were crowds? How in general do you feel about things reflecting a couple days later?
I think having some nice weather during the week really was great. And we had strong visitation. And whenever you're 100% open, well, I should say we had one trail that didn't open. So almost 100% open, and we got all our lifts running. I think it was a great experience for our guest staff. Really stepped up as they always do. And the holiday week was strong. And, you know, we're looking forward to heading into a strong spring.
What was that one trail that was closed, Bruce?
I think it was Evergreen. I'd have to look, but it was a gladed trail that we had a little problem getting out of the trail. But everything else, the team worked really hard to keep them open.
All right. So smooth President's Week, and that's good. And I'm not going to say you can coast into spring, but I know things get a little less intense in general as we go into April and toward Okemo's traditional closing date. It was a rough run-up to the ski season. Up to 8 inches of rain hit Ludlow and Okemo in July. Lots of flooding. Just how extensive was the damage, Bruce, both to the town of Ludlow and to Okemo itself?
You know, I would say that Okemo dodged a bullet. We did not have as much flooding as the community did. So on that day, back in July, July 11th, got a phone call around 3 a.m. and there was water in the base lodge. So I called some of the team, came in and got ourselves situated, and then started helping with the community. The roads were impassable right in that morning. So we got some of our equipment down there and started working and helping the community. The team worked quickly to get things back on track here at the resort, and it was only 3 weeks after the flooding that we were able to reopen for mountain biking and scenic chairlift rides in our adventure zone.
I mean, Bruce, you've been at this for a long time. When you get that 3 a.m. phone call, I imagine this is not the first time that's happened. How long does it take you to switch from, man, I'm tired and I want to go back to bed, to emergency mode and you're just on and the adrenaline's flowing?
Oh, it's right after you get the call, it's up and get going, get out of the house and communicate with other team members who are right there, you know, ready to go and to come in and help. We knew there was some damage in the community and we wanted to help support that. Once we got our own facility shored up, we were able to do that, but it's quick. And many of us spent that night here at Okemo because we couldn't get back because the roads were impassable around our homes. But once the next day, we were able to get back.
So can you talk a little bit, Bruce, about the relationship between Okemo and Ludlow? I mean, every ski area and ski town has a distinct relationship. In Vermont, it's especially close given the small size of the state. What's that relationship like? And how did that work during the emergency? How were you able to help out the town specifically?
Well, I'm really proud steward of the Okemo team and the Vail Resorts team for what we were able to do to help. The relationship with the town is, I feel, is strong. We are able to speak with the community leaders. There are things that we can help with. And they also offer to help us if need be. So we do need each other. We were able to put some of the emergency workers that were displaced and some neighbors in the Jackson Gore Inn. We had condominium owners calling and offering their space, and we used some of that. We also provided some supplies. We had Nature Valley granola bars, some Gatorade that we had in storage to help bring it to the ambulance and the police station where there was swift water rescue that was there to, staged if any help was needed. And then we started trying to remove debris. We worked in the town of Ludlow. We worked with the state of Vermont as we're on state property and there's a road to the summit of Okemo. And we also helped the Green Mountain Railroad because it's an active railroad that goes through the community, providing labor for help form cleanup. We paid our employees to go and help clean up in the community. They went to homes, mucked out basements, removed debris. So it's a very strong relationship in my opinion.
So we're talking now 7 months after these storms hit and the national media showed up in Ludlow to capture the damage. And that always happens. So we always see the worst of it. And it's hard to imagine from the outside, the other side of that and how that gets fixed. And the national media does tend to step away at a certain point. So we don't really get to see the after as much as the before. So take us into this, Bruce. 7 months later, what does Ludlow look like today? What is the recovery like and what's still left to do?
Well, I would say that the biggest challenge that we have in the community is there's no grocery store. And this is a big challenge for the residents of the town. You know, people that are coming in and visiting, they have a more of an opportunity to adjust. Whereas the residents, it's a real issue and challenge. And you've got to travel 30 minutes to the closest large grocery store. There are a couple smaller ones within, probably 10 minutes. So I'd say that's the biggest. We do have some restaurants that have not opened that have been a factor in the community. And I think as we get into the springtime, there's some recreation areas, dog park like that, that will need some repair in the community. So those are probably the largest that we have, but the grocery store is the biggest thing.
Are there plans to bring that back? Was it a national chain that got hit? What's the plan?
It was a national chain, and the plan is in the community, we're being told that it looks like it's going to be in June. They're coming back, and they're coming back stronger with some floodproofing that they're working on to raise the entrances. So as you come in, I don't know the full logistics behind it, but they're committed to coming back.
That's great. So as I understand it, Bruce, you actually served on the Ludlow Select Board and were chair of that body for several years. For those unfamiliar with Vermont politics, what can you tell us about select boards and how important that relationship has been both to Okemo and to Ludlow, as you've been an important part of both over the years?
It's an important relationship. Ludlow is managed on a town manager form of government. So the select board hires a town manager who handles the day-to-day operation. So the select board approves purchases and you sign weekly purchases and weekly orders for payroll. But we are policymakers. We put people as a select board. People are put onto boards, development review board and the planning commission and other boards. But the select board is kind of the guiding body and directs the town manager as needed. But the town manager handles the day-to-day operation. I served 21 years and it was a great opportunity for me to learn that. I'm a fifth generation Vermonter, grew up in Ludlow, graduated from Black River High School. So it was great to give back to my town. But hey, I put my time in. 21 years is long enough, and it was a good run for me.
So you're a native Vermonter, so there has to be some pride in looking around Ludlow and seeing the extent of the recovery. And we've seen this over and over again in Vermont. When there's a natural disaster, the people there just get to work. They don't sit around necessarily and wait for FEMA to come in. Now, of course, all that helps and that's all part of it. But I was always struck by these images after Irene of folks pulling out their, you know, little tractors and starting to fix the highways. So what is it about Vermont and the character of the people up there that makes them so resilient, so self-sufficient in cases where it would be easy to just give up?
Yeah, maybe it's something in the mountain air, you know, Stuart. I don't really know, but it is so true. You know, we are Vermont. We talk about Vermont strong, and there's such a resilience and a leaning in and a kindness to those in the community, and it really makes it an amazing place to live. You know, we have the motto for the town of Ludlow, to amazing place to live, work, and play, and it really is. And we put aside the challenges that people might have and the different opinions on things and really just, what are we going to do? And there were so many local individuals that stepped up and worked at the community center and really just started helping neighbors. And there were so many donations that came in. It was really just great to see. It's really why I love calling Vermont my home.
So even taking this nationally for a moment, Vail Resorts did play a part in the recovery. And though, as you noted, the damage to Okemo Resort itself was pretty small, you have a lot of employees, and a lot of them, I would imagine, live right there in Ludlow. Can you talk a little bit about Vail's My Epic Promise Foundation here, Bruce? What can you tell us about how My Epic Promise may have been tapped to help employees recover from storm damage in Ludlow?
It was such a hard time for so many people, and I'm really grateful for, you know, what the team did to provide housing to those in needs. We ensured that the team had access to grants through our Epic Promise Employee Foundation. Those grants provided assistance for some individuals who had property damage or extraordinary expenses due to the storm. Epic Wellness is something that we're so proud of because staff can receive mental health resources, including 24/7 crisis counseling. And we were able to give out employees that were affected grocery and hardware store gift cards. And, you know, I was able to write personal notes to many of them. And then I think the thing that is just kind of out of the blue, we received support from other resorts, Stevens Pass in Washington and Attitash in New Hampshire. They donated some of their employee experience funding to buy more gift cards for our employees. And we helped host a community concert and barbecue at Jackson Gore following the flooding in late July. So it was just great to see across our company and able to support our team.
So I imagine there's a lot of pride just personally, Bruce, having grown up in Ludlow and seeing that spirit and being able to help and give back in that way. So you mentioned you grew up in Ludlow. Did you grow up skiing? And did you grow up skiing at Okemo?
I did. My mother was a ski instructor in the late 60s, early 70s here at Okemo. I learned to ski here at Okemo with the Palmas. If you didn't weigh enough, you got kind of flung around, but you learn over time. And then my family, we would ski. We didn't ski a lot, but we would ski at Pico, ski at Killington, sometimes Round Top. And of course, our company and Okemo, we still host the school program. We have, I think it's 6 weeks of school programs for local in the region. So every day from Monday through Thursday, we have a school or a couple schools here. And that's how I would ski all winter doing that. And it was just a great opportunity.
So talk a little bit about Okemo in those days and your first memories of it. You mentioned the Palmas. So Okemo had maybe more surface lifts than any ski area in New England at one point. It was a much different mountain than the pretty polished experience you'd have today. So just talk a little bit about what Okemo was like and what you remember from those days.
Well, as I was growing up, it was Palma lifts, and then there were some chair lifts that were added, but it was just a fun experience. You could go out and there wasn't as many trails, but you learned to ski in a lot of different conditions, maybe more so than what we do now. But, you know, we were always in the woods and, you know, we were always just having a really good time. And the community and the employees were always looking out for you when your parents drop you off. And I like to think that I still see that today. We have kids coming up that I know that their families in town, and it's just great to know that they can just come up and ski and have a really good time. And it's a great experience for them.
So it's been a big part of your life, it sounds like, as long as you can remember. And your mom worked there as a ski instructor, as you said. What was your first job at Okemo? When and how old were you?
My first job at Okemo was in 1978.
Wow.
So let's see, I was 15. And
amazing.
I worked as a busser in the base lodge, and you would clean tables and trays and work in the food and beverage area.
If I told you in 1978 that in 2024, you would still be working at the resort and that you'd be leading the resort, would you have believed it?
You know, I don't know. I've never really been asked that question, but I'd say that if the 18-year-old self of me could look forward and say, hey, where would you be? I think I enjoy living in this area, and I enjoy what Vermont has to offer. So I knew that. Both my parents still live around the same area that I grew up in. They sold the house, but we had some land, and we grew up on a horse farm. Mm-hmm. My wife and I have family in the area. So it seemed like a really good way to live, and I didn't have that much desire to try something else.
So your Okemo story of working there really started in the 70s. I noted your current string of working there started in the late 80s. Kind of take us through your time from being a busboy in the lodge to when you started your career there in 1987. What are the little twists and turns in there that brought you to the resort full time?
So I was so fortunate that the principal, his name was Ray, Mr. Packard, at Black River High School, said, you know, you ought to consider a work study. You seem to like working at Okemo. Let me see if I can call up there. And he did. And so my senior year, I was able to do a work study in the afternoon. So I would go up at noon, and I was able to, I worked for Ed Rock, who was the general manager, was good friends with him, his family. And he allowed me to try so many different jobs and would encourage me and kind of like, go to this department or go this. And I really got to really understand and really enjoy the multifaceted, the experiences that you would have. And, you know, fast forward after high school, I probably wasn't quite ready for college or played soccer at Plymouth State, but only spent a year there. I came back, and in the summer of 82, Tim and Diane Muller purchased Okemo on August 2nd, and I was hired by the head of snowmaking at the time, a gentleman by the name of Kirk Turner, on August 10th, and I stayed right straight through there and learned a lot of different things and did a lot of different jobs, from lift maintenance to snowmaking to grooming to just understanding mountain operations. And then I decided I need to go back to college, so I was able to go back as a sophomore to Linden State, which is now Vermont University, and I was able to go back and spend time there, come back and work summers and winters. We were building lifts at the time, and then I graduated December of 87, started work right after I graduated.
I know it can be hard to identify a moment over the course of decades, but as you think back on the last 40 plus years, was there a moment, Bruce, was there one thing that made you stay at Okemo? Was it more of an accumulation of things, or was there a moment when you said, this is my place, this is where I want to make my career?
I guess I would say, Stuart, you know, in those situations, as you probably look back, the support and the mentoring that I was receiving, a gentleman by the name of Barry Tucker, Gary Martin, who did lift maintenance, Barry was the head of mountain operations, Tim and Diane Muller, the support and the comfort that I felt there, and I could see that there was growth. So it was probably as I came back out of college and started adding on different jobs. I was the assistant general manager at one point under Don McCaskill, who ended up going and being the GM president at Whitetail. He taught me so much and he would tell me, like, you just need to keep pushing and, you know, keep adding responsibilities and you're going to be in this chair at some point. So I would say it was probably right after the first few years after I got out of college.
So let's focus on the Mullers here for a moment. You mentioned that they purchased the resort in 1982, and really their leadership and tenure is who we have to thank for the modern Okemo. And obviously Vail's owned it for a little while now, and we can talk about what they've added in a bit here. But just talk about the Mullers' legacy here, Bruce, as you reflect on the decades that they owned it, and what made them such a great fit for Okemo and for Ludlow and to help grow that into a major resort in New England.
Well, it's so amazing, and I really feel that the community and Okemo itself is so fortunate to have Tim and Diane purchase and become part of the owners of Okemo. Very hands-on, guest-focused, they appreciated hard work and they rewarded loyalty, but they had a vision and a drive to be better. Many of the situations we created things as we were going along, kind of like building the plane as you're flying, but they knew that having good snowmaking, a good lift system, having development that was controlled and was really planned out around the resort was really important. And by doing all of that and growing the team, adding to the community, supporting the community, really made it a lasting relationship in the area. I think the cornerstone was the adding of the Jackson Gore area, the highlight of the Jackson Gore area. And it changed the way the resort skied, and it changed the way the resort was perceived, having the hotel and the lift system in that area. It just was really a great step. So they were just great people to work for. And I think they were just so humble for what they brought to it and really just wanted to be better in the community and wanted to be better at the resort.
So it's easy to survey New England skiing and its modern day footprint and just assume it was inevitable. But going back to the mid-80s here, or back to the 80s when the Mullers arrived, I mean, Okemo was just a mid-sized ski area. It was kind of small. It was, you know, basic footprint of Magic or Bromley or Ascutney or Plymouth, or also known as Round Top, as you mentioned. So it wasn't inevitable that Okemo would become this 600-plus acre behemoth that it is today. What is it, from your point of view, Bruce, that set Okemo apart and ignited that sustained growth, while the other ski areas that I mentioned, they stayed mid-sized or small, some closed down altogether, some like Ascutney are much smaller now, and others like Magic, you know, Magic's doing okay right now, but it's really struggled over the years. So what was it about Okemo that allowed it to grow into this major player while other ski areas around it maybe didn't have that success?
Well, I think that Tim and Diane, you know, it was inevitable that Okemo was going to grow. They had grown their operation in the Virgin Islands. They had two resorts down there. They were going to treat Okemo as a business, and there would be expectations of stronger financial outcomes and therefore growth of the resort. They planned the development and worked with developers, had the property to be able to do that, and were able to be around the mountain. I'm not sure I can speak for the other resorts and their strategy, but I will say that the Muller embraced the growth of slope-side housing, and they looked at the areas of the resort without any skiing on it and Take Solitude, South Face, and then Jackson Gore, and they had a vision. I think it's because of the Muller's vision that Okemo today has the enhanced lifts and the state-of-the-art snowmaking, and continues to have the strong guest service mentality, the family focus. And that's really something that we have hung our hat on. We call it internally the Okemo difference. It was actually a marketing tagline probably 15, 20 years ago. But there is an Okemo difference, and we continue to push that to this day.
Looking at these expansions, and you mentioned Jackson Gore, which came online in 2002 to 3 ski season, was kind of the big one that really changed how people were perceived. But you've been a part of and witnessed, and I imagine really helped move along a lot of expansions. There was Solitude in 1987, South Face in 1994, Morningstar in 1995. When did you sense that Okemo had become a peer resort to Killington and Sugarbush and Stowe and Mount Snow and all these other major Vermont resorts? Was that something that sort of happened gradually, or was that Jackson Gore opened and you knew Okemo was big time at that point?
You know, that's an interesting question, Stuart. I think, in my opinion, we focused on who we were. We didn't focus on those others. Mm-hmm. So I'm not sure that we were even thought we were in competition with them. Mm-hmm. I think I'm sure that there were times and situations where we were, but we were so ingrained in how do we make Okemo better. And, you know, I'm not sure I ever thought it was Okemo as a big time resort as I was living it and just going about doing my job. You know, you think about how we would do, kind of understand a little bit how many people we might have on the mountain back then 20 years ago. There wasn't any lift ticket scanning. So mm-hmm. we'd spend 15 minutes in a lift liner at the top of the lift looking to see if a guest had a lift ticket. We knew how many tickets we sold. So we'd count the total number of skiers we saw and then do the math, because we assumed if they didn't have a lift ticket, they had a season's pass. We'd kind of predict how many pass holders skied. That's not the most scientific way.
Right.
But, you know, we went about it and we were like, you know, this is working for us. So I think that it's probably, we view these resorts, we probably viewed them as peers, even though they were probably bigger than us. Mm-hmm. And we just kept doing our thing.
You know, you kept expanding, and I want to focus on that for a moment. We hear a lot about Act 250 in Vermont. It's Vermont's sort of environmental law or set of guidelines that guide development, and it can get a bad name, and it can make it seem difficult to develop in Vermont, but you've been able to expand and build a lot of residential stuff. Just talk about that balance over the years, Bruce, and how you've been able to work within the constructs of the state's Act 250 regulations, but still grow Okemo substantially over that time.
I think Tim and Diane and Vail, our company now being part of Okemo, we're so mindful and respectful of the environment. Mm-hmm. So Act 250 is a way to look at the project and look at what the impacts are going to be. So We would work with, we had a development team. Dan Petraska was our VP of development and did an excellent job with his team of what are we going to do to get through these Act 250 hurdles. Traffic continues and will continue to be a challenge that we all have to be part of. But the environment is so important to us as a resort and as someone who lives this in this area, all of us, we want to be protecting the environment. So it's finding a balance. It's finding how we can maybe put development in, how we can make sure that the impact works well with what's around, works well with the mountain, the partnership that we have with the state of Vermont. So yes, there are some challenges. I think Act 250, you hear a lot of different ways that people may perceive it, but I think it's a guide. And if you are able to follow that guide and work with it and figure out how to compromise, it's something that has helped keep the state of Vermont on a better path.
So the Mullers did a really good job of balancing that, but their tenure came to an end in 2018 when they sold to Vail Resorts, and I think a lot of folks were surprised. I'm really curious to hear how you reacted, Bruce, and I imagine it wasn't a surprise for you. I imagine you were part of the process, but how did you react when the Mullers informed you that they were looking to sell and that they were selling to Vail Resorts?
Well, let's face it, initially it was a shock. Stuart, you hear those things and you're like, oh, is that really going to happen? It was evident that something was going on. We were being asked to answer questions, provide information on spreadsheets, gather information. What was kind of interesting in this situation is I actually thought there was something going on with some refinancing because we were always doing that with the CNL lease structure. So it wasn't a lot different that we were kind of gathering. But then Tim approached me and let me know that he was in discussion, he and Diane with Vail Resorts about a sale. We kept the information, he has to be keep confidential because Tim and Diane, first and foremost, they wanted to have a seamless transition for the employees, for our guests, and for our community. And they wanted the process to go well. And it was almost to some degree like it was the right thing to do, but they didn't want people to feel like they were selling out or something like that. And let's face it, they earned all that they did. So that's kind of how it went. I think they were successful in being able to do that and make sure all the stakeholders knew what was kind of going on.
So talk about that transition period a little bit, Bruce, both for you personally. I mean, you have new bosses after 31 years. I imagine that's a transition. And then just for the employees at large and the resort at large, what went well and where could Vail maybe have done a better job?
Well, let's face it, it was a new experience. It was exciting and positive. I was extremely fortunate to be able to stay with the company. I really enjoyed working with Pat Campbell, Doug Perini, first few months in the year of integration. I've learned to adjust to having my boss in Colorado, Tim Baker, who is just phenomenal supporter of myself and Okemo. But let's face it, I had Tim Mueller 30 feet away in an office. But I do appreciate the trust and the empowerment that our company puts in us as leaders across the country and really across the world. Hey, whenever you're having some type of change, there's going to be criticism. There's going to be people thinking it should be done better. But our company puts so much into that, those type of integrations. But change is hard for some. But I would say that we worked very well together as we made this integration. And people realized there were going to be some changes, but over time, the integration went well.
So, last word on the Mullers here, as you look back at their 36 years as owners of Okemo, what's their legacy, both at Okemo and in New England skiing in general? Because they also own Mount Sunapee for a number of years and Crested Butte. But as you look back at them, I mean, it was only three resorts, but it was three really important resorts and three really important places. So, what's your take on this, Bruce, as an observer of what the Mullers left behind to skiing?
I would say that their legacy, they're going to be remembered for resurrecting Okemo and making the ski experience at Okemo extremely family friendly. The guest experience was always first and foremost under their leadership, and they always had this desire to make things better, whether it be snowmaking, grooming, the resort infrastructure, and to provide, as I mentioned, the Okemo difference. They always treated employees and guests as family, and always supported the community. Diane was very involved in education. This showed in her and Tim's support of the schools in the region and the resort's overall support of community initiatives. And I think it says a lot that they've been out for 5 years and they were elected to the Ski and Snowboard Hall of Fame here in Vermont. And it's such an honor that was this past October, and such an honor and so deserved for all that they've done here at Okemo.
So nonetheless, the transition went on and Vail Resorts has been operating the resort for 6 years now. The first big change for you, or maybe not the first big change, but a big change for you came later that year in 2018 when you ended up as VP and GM of Sunapee. How did that happen, Bruce? Did you volunteer for that? Were you ready for something new? Did Vail just shuffle you around? What can you tell us about how you ended up at Sunapee and what that experience was like?
Well, I'll start with it. The experience was just awesome. It was really good for me to do. And I tell people when they ask me, it was so good for me because it got me out of my comfort zone. And I was like, hey, I know everything here, you know, and then I go to Sunapee and I don't know hardly anything and I have to learn. And it was really good. So, you know, I was, as the sale came together, I was asked to stay on as GM. I knew it was a great opportunity and one I didn't really want to pass up, you know, and I knew that it didn't always happen when resorts changed ownership. So after the sale was complete, I met with Pat Campbell and she said, we want you to stay, but we want you to go to Mount Sunapee. She gave me some time to think about it, you know, a few days, and I talked to my wife and my kids, and I made the decision I was going to go take the opportunity, and it was really, really good to learn something new. Yeah, I mean, I had some disappointment in my first few hours, but I just was like, I'm going to go do this, and I'm going to go enjoy it, and I had no understanding about what that might mean, the timing or how long it might be, and so, you know, I continued the hard work that Jay Gamble, who was the GM at the time, had done over the past 20 years. And the team really came together. So it was really good for me and something that I'll always cherish.
So for the listeners who are not as familiar with New England, Sunapee is only an hour from Okemo. Did you even have to move or were you able to commute over there?
I was able to commute, but if it had been longer, I probably would have moved.
So you only were at Sunapee for about a year. What brought you back to Okemo in 2019 and how good did it feel to be back home?
Well, it was bittersweet in the sense of, you know, I hadn't been there that long and I had really created some good relationships with the Sunapee team, but I was excited to come back. After the Peaks acquisition, Doug Perini was promoted to the VP and CEO of the Eastern Region. And I was asked to return to Okemo as Vice President and General Manager. And to have managerial oversight of general managers for Crotchet and Mount Sunapee, who report to me now. But I was excited to come back, but also know that I was going to continue to work with those two resorts to help Crotchet in their integration with Vail Resorts and to help keep Mount Sunapee moving forward. And Mount Sunapee is a little unique because you're on state land and it's a leasehold. Mm-hmm. So it's a little bit different. And what the relationships that we have and the relationships I had, just really, it was a really great experience for me.
So it's hard to think about New England skiing now without thinking about Vail Resorts, but really the company is still has not even been there for a decade. They bought Stowe in 2017, bought Okemo and Sunapee in 2018, bought all of Peak Resorts, which included Mount Snow and Crotchet and Wildcat and Attitash in 2019. So this all came together really fast. Of course, we had a lot of other big world events in there that maybe skewed our perception of time. Vail has brought a lot of leaders in from the West. And sometimes when you come from the West, it can be harder to appreciate some of the mechanics of operating a ski area in New England. For example, snowmaking and the importance of it, the icing of lifts that happens, the freeze-thaw cycles. What have you been able to help the company understand, Bruce, about the very particular climate and also culture of New England that maybe really requires a different approach from what they were used to taking at Keystone and Breck and Vail and Beaver Creek and these other mountains that have a lot more natural snow and don't have to deal with freeze-thaws and things like that, and also just have a very different culture around them?
Well, I guess I would say, I think it's a myth that our company, that Vail Resorts wants to come in and just change the way that we are going to do things. Any of the experiences I've had are hey, this is how we've done things. Here are some options that we might want to look at. But at the same time, we understand that this is what we've been doing. Now, we also, as operators of the resorts, have to make sure that we're not be like, well, that's how we've always done it. But I've worked with so many talented team members, and the goals are so similar across our company. And they ask me about understanding our guests, the community, state of Vermont. I really tell anybody that will listen that our company expects me and the team to manage and operate the resorts that we oversee. So the decisions that we make are made right here on the ground. And I can tell you that if we do something right, it's because of a decision that we made. And if we do something that maybe wasn't right, it's a decision that we made. So it's important to note that. And it's important to realize that many of the same employees that were here with Tim and Diane are still here. And I'm so proud of the team and how they have stuck with the company, because it's really a great company to work for.
So I want to give you a chance to respond in particular about the topic of snowmaking. There's obviously tons of noise these days that the Mullers didn't have to deal with back in the 80s and 90s, right? With social media and everyone has an opinion. And there's a perception that is pretty persistent that Vail maybe doesn't invest as much in snowmaking as you would expect in New England. So I'll just give you an opportunity to react to that. What does snowmaking look like at Okemo under Vail as compared to what it looked like under the Mullers, and how much of those decisions remain local?
Well, the commitment and the approach to snowmaking is extremely similar on how it was before becoming part of the company. So I would say, no, there's no change. Our senior manager, Mountain Ops, Eb Kinney, he's been with our company for 35 years, and he's extremely committed to what he does with snowmaking, leadership of his team, providing exceptional experience for the guest. We also have snowmaking leaders with significant longevity with our company. We continue to start making snow in November, and we end in February. Let's face it, COVID had impacted, and we had a tough year, 21, 22, with staffing, but that wasn't the norm. And I really feel we've rebounded, and we're as committed to snowmaking as ever. And it's really important to us. And I'm so proud of the team, and really proud of the great job that they're doing.
So the Mullers, again, great operators, respected nationally, and Vail, if you look at their history of recent purchases, they've really focused on these small conglomerates of really well done, really well run resorts. They don't really purchase fix up jobs and try to repair them in general. So obviously they saw that the Mullers had done a great job with all three of their ski areas. And the Mullers obviously would want to preserve that legacy when they sold, right? So they clearly thought, as you said earlier, that selling to a national operator, to Vail Resorts, was in the best interests of their legacy, their resorts, their employees, who I imagine they cared a great deal about. So what were those advantages, Bruce, of being part of Vail as you've seen it, rather than when you were part of a small company?
I think there are many, Stuart. Resources, for sure, as one example. Our company has a track record of investing in capital across all our resorts, from lifts to snowmaking to the guest experience. We focus on talent development, invest in our people. That is so impressive what we've been doing and what we do. And I really feel that we're a company that truly believes that our people are our greatest asset. And that was the way it was with Tim and Diane. We're committed to a strong talent pool, and we have a network of some of the most talented employees and individuals out there. And it's not just on the mountain, it's across all business lines. And I would say our company has some of the strongest employees and employee growth programs, in the industry. But we also live our values and can make a huge impact with that. And we believe in giving back and working in the communities, supporting the industry. And I like to think that we try to make the world a better place. And I don't view it as just talk. I view it as what we live. And being part of a large company means that we can have a bigger impact. So I guess to kind of finish it up, the natural environment to work and play, I love. And we believe in the stewardship, as I mentioned previously. We're all proud of that. And we truly take our responsibility to heart every single day.
So Vail has invested a lot into its New England resorts, and the biggest, most noticeable change from a skier point of view, at least from the peanut gallery here, came in 2021 when you did this big switcheroo. The Green Ridge Triple came out. You took the Quantum 4 high-speed quad. And obviously, this is not telling you anything you don't know, but setting this up for the listeners. Took the Quantum 4 high-speed quad, moved it over to replace the Green Ridge Triple. Then you brought a new six-pack in on the old Quantum 4 line to serve that Jackson Gore train. I'm really curious about the decision-making. If you can take us behind the scenes on this project, Bruce, what are the various configurations you considered? Because often the lifts you end up with are not all the different plans you considered. And ultimately, how did you land on moving that high-speed quad over to replace the Green Ridge Triple and then bring your new six-pack to Jackson Gore?
Well, it was evident that we needed to have some more capacity in Jackson Gore. We knew we wanted to also replace the last Alpenmeyer lift and provide faster access to the summit. So it was a good decision and it made sense to address those two lifts. The existing lift configuration, it worked well. So we felt using the same setup, we focused on upgrading the lifts, which would allow for more uphill capacity. We knew adding a bubble to the Evergreen Summit Express would be impactful for our guests. It's a much more comfortable ride and shields riders from the wind. And that's where you get more of that type of weather as you approach the summit.
How challenging was this project? And you've been a part of every lift installation, pretty much of every existing lift at Okemo. I mean, how challenging was this project, moving one lift, putting in an all new lift, tearing down two lifts all in the space of one off season?
Yeah, I actually helped build the Green Ridge. So I remember that project.
Wow.
The project was turnkey, actually. We have a great relationship with Leitner Palma and their team did most of the work. We assisted with site work and some of the build, but when you're not clearing a lift line, which all lift lines were done at this point, and this one, there's less work. And so it was less of a challenge, but it was in on time.
You didn't have to widen that Jackson Gore line for that sixer?
We did not.
Oh, it's nice. So when Okemo built the Sunburst 6 in 2014, put bubbles on it. The next year, Okemo retroactively added bubbles to the Quantum 4 in 2015. That did lift dates to 2002. Why didn't we get bubbles when you installed Quantum 6?
Yeah, the Quantum 6 is just a shorter lift and it's not as exposed. Mm-hmm. So really didn't feel that the bubbles were necessary given where it was and the conditions that you see over in Jackson Gore.
Is there something philosophically that Vail doesn't like about bubbles? I can't remember the last time they built a bubble lift, and I'm not sure if you can speak for the whole company on this point, but perhaps as you were getting feedback on Quantum 6, any background that you can give us on why Vail just in general doesn't build bubble lifts?
You know, I cannot give any background on that, but I can say that as we do look at, you know, the Quantum, it was a decision here on the ground that we felt like, hey, we don't feel we need to have this over here on the Quantum and never really push forward. And we just know there's a different weather pattern at the summit than there is in Jackson Gore.
3 years in, how happy are you with this big alignment of all these lifts, Bruce? Was it the right decision? Is there anything you'd do differently?
We're very satisfied between the Quantum 6, so upgrades in Jackson Gore. We've added snowmaking. We added some on White Lightning, Vortex. Mm-hmm. We're just giving guests more options, so they're staying in that area and alleviating pressure on some of the other lift pods. The Evergreen Express, you know, we changed it after the first year from a contour load to a straight load, and it's just so much better for our guests. So I would say that the terrain is great off of both of the lifts, and we're happy, and our guests tell us they like the additions that we did. So I think it's been a great feeling.
So interesting that you mentioned that Green Ridge Triple was the last, and I think the only Doppelmayr lift that's ever been on Okemo. Vail in general, I think just given the size of the company, does a mix of Doppelmayr and Palma lifts throughout its portfolio. Okemo is 100% Palma. Talk about Okemo's history with that company and how important it was to you if you advocated to continue that tradition when they began upgrading the lift fleet of, hey, you know, Doppelmayr, I understand your relationship with them, but Palma is really works for Okemo.
You know, people sometimes forget Palma was well known in the US in the 80s and Doppelmayr was more of a European brand at the time. But Palma was based in Woodstock, Vermont with Bill Alsop. So at the time, as we were putting in lifts, it was really easy to get supplies. They were building it from there, get parts and whatnot. So We had a great relationship, and the transition has been easy as Doppmeyer has become bigger in the United States. So purchasing from one manufacturer is ideal, and it's important to have interchangeable parts on the shelves when a problem arises. So it's worked out really well for us, but being that close when they were in Woodstock, it was somewhat of a no-brainer for us.
So that was a big upgrade. Looking to the future, Bruce, what's your wish list to upgrade Okemo's lift fleet as you survey what you have now?
You know, our goal is going to be continue to make sure our guests have a great time on the mountain, and we're going to continue to evaluate the lift fleet and ensure we have a plan for flow and accessibility. We have 9 quad chairs with a few out of base areas. Maybe upgrading one to a 6-pack down the road would be nice, but really don't have any plans for that right now.
So you have 6 high-speed lifts right now. Your oldest lifts on the mountain are all fixed grip. You have the Black Ridge Triple, which dates to 1984, the Sachem fixed grip quad dates to 1989, the A and B quads, which come out of the base, date to 1990 and 1985, respectively. It sounds like perhaps a 6-pack there would be ideal in the long run, but just not committing to this, but what's just your general thinking around those 4 lifts, how happy you are with them, and what might work well in their place, whether you'd stick with fixed grip or look to go high speed?
Well, you know, you talk about, and people do talk about lift age, and I think it's important to note that these lifts are in great shape, even though they are older. And it's really not as much about the age as it is the upkeep. You know, we're constantly doing maintenance and updating important components like gearbox, motors, cable. So the frame may be old, but everything else is new and well kept. We really feel, you know, the way it is right now, as we mentioned, there may be some ideas of trying to do something down the road, but skier flow on the mountain is set up pretty well with the configuration we have. So I would say it would probably remain similar.
Is there anywhere that you would like to add a lift? Like, do you like redundancy or where you could use a lift that you don't have one now?
I would say, you know, kind of the way our system works, lift system is really the only place that I'd consider probably putting in another lift would be in Jackson Gore to add another access point out of the base of Jackson Gore.
So where Coleman Brook comes up or where the Quantum 6 comes up and maybe in a different direction.
It would most likely, if we did anything, it would go a different direction from where Coleman Brook goes starts.
Oh, okay. So it would start with Coleman Brook and then what would be an ideal landing spot? Jackson Gore Junction or somewhere else on the hill?
Most likely, it would be from the base of Jackson Gore up towards the top of Solitude, you know, maybe to the summit. If we did anything, it would most likely be an access coming out of the Jackson Gore.
That's really interesting. As you look at those projects and future projects in general, I mean, when I look at Okemo on Google Maps, I see a lot of green, right? So what is the expansion potential, if any, around Okemo? Does Vail own that land? You mentioned Sunapee's estate lease, but I'm not certain what your situation is at Okemo. So what, who owns the land and what sort of expansion opportunities, if any, are there?
So the border, you should look at Okemo is like from the halfway point to the summit is owned by the state of Vermont. So below that, in Jackson Gore, from the railroad tracks below are owned by Okemo, and everything else is owned by the state of Vermont. So there isn't a lot of potential in our leasehold that we have. So I don't envision there being, yes, you mentioned there's a lot of green, but I think our uphill, I really feel confident our uphill and our downhill capacity work well together. So we're not looking to expand any of that at this point.
We'll talk about grooming a little bit here, Bruce. Okemo is one of the most aggressive groomers really anywhere. I mean, you groom almost every trail every night, from what I can tell from looking at your trail updates in the morning. And Okemo is more aggressive traditionally than, say, like Killington or Sugar Bush or some of your neighbors to the north. To what extent has this been a conscious effort to set Okemo apart from your competitors? And to what extent is it just sort of playing to your demographic and that's what your skiers want?
We know that it's the experience that keeps our guests coming back. And, you know, the trail conditions are a big part of the experience. Guests have come to know great snow coverage, consistent quality, and we want to make sure we deliver. So you're right. Most nights our grooming team does go out and lays down the famous Okemo corduroy, and it is by design. And we know our guests appreciate it, and we feel it's something that sets us apart.
Yeah, I as someone who likes terrain variety, I find myself wishing that there were a few more bumps sometimes when I'm skiing around Okemo. Do you get that feedback ever, or are your skiers pretty much happy with that grooming philosophy?
Well, we try to be inclusive to all, so individuals like yourself that want to have we have some mogul trails. We leave some terrain natural. If you looked at today's report, you'd see that. But we try to have some moguls in each pod, but with the weather that's been this year, it's been a little bit harder with not much natural snow. But we try to have terrain that they are maybe surrounding a mogul trail. It may have some groomers and maybe there'll be some natural. We've added some glades that are a little bit easier. So we do want to make sure that if we have some moguls, that we have some groomers nearby so everybody can enjoy.
Yeah, you do have some great tree runs there, and I really like those blue runs that you put in at the top. In comparison to Stratton or Killington, the percentage of gladed terrain that Okemo has is small. Is there expansion opportunity for more glades within Okemo? And if so, where would that be?
For now, I don't envision that we'll have any more. We have a pretty good balance of terrain, so there's no plan, to add more glades.
How popular have those blue glades been? I really like those trails, Everglade and Whispering Pines up toward the top for the listeners, and Whistler as well.
I mean, I agree with you, Stuart. They have been a great addition, and our guests, nothing but positive. And they were added to give our guests some more options. So people love them. The team has worked really hard. A lot of times, you have to do a little bit of work to be able to get into them. And then once you're in there, it goes pretty well. But they've been very, very popular.
Yeah, I mean, you've been at this a long time, and when I first started skiing at Okemo, all the glades were double blacks. And that's intimidating, right? When you go from a mostly groomed mountain and you want to try glades, and your first experience with that is double black diamonds. So I'd really be really interested in your perspective on how the industry approach to glades has evolved over the decades, because blue glades is not something that you would have seen a few decades ago, really, at most mountains in the country.
Well, it's kind of interesting because this was brought up by some of our employees in our ski and ride department. And, they were going into some of these woods and we were like, hey, that's not really what we, and they're like, can we make some of these? And so we started looking at it and we're like, that's not a bad idea. So it really started with them giving us some ideas because a lot of those are, you have to make them by hand. So we had to commit the manpower in the summer to go in and get the permits to be able to create the trails. But it really started with that. And we're so great to just an example of how the entire team is part of the process. And look what we have. We have some really good blue and green glades.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of that, and your team's done a great job of introducing that variety. So I want to talk about snowmaking here, Bruce. 128 trails at Okemo. That's one of the larger trail footprints anywhere in the East. And that would not really be feasible most years just relying on natural snow alone. Okemo has just an amazing snowmaking system, probably one of the best in the entire world. Just what can you tell us about the scale and power of this snowmaking system and its ability to cover large amounts of terrain in a short amount of time?
It's 122 trails. We actually include the terrain parks of that. So that's why you get the 128.
Got it.
But yeah, I mean, the system is phenomenal. And again, the commitment from the Muller family to understanding the importance of snowmaking. We've seen a lot of changes. We put some upgrades in, in the past few years. But the success of our snowmaking system is from the team that run it. And you can have all the equipment you want, but we really would need the team that we have. We've added about 33, new low energy guns around the mountain, put some new snowmaking pipe on the upper timberline. But investing in snowmaking is important because we just don't get enough of the natural snow, and we know that we can rely on the equipment we have and our team's experience. And then, of course, low energy guns help us make snow more efficient in less time.
Where are you at on automation, Bruce?
We are not that far on automation. We have one gun. We have a Techno Alpen that is completely automated. It's right in our base area. We do have six or seven HKD click hydrants, which they aren't fully automated, but compared to the traditional hydrant and hose, they speed up the snowmaking process. You can start the gun as quickly as 1 to 2 minutes instead of 5 to 10 minutes in the old school, way. But it's something that we're continuing to look at, and I have no doubt you're going to see more automation and additional in the coming years.
What's your water source like? They're kind of getting back to Act 250. I know there can be some constraints on water use in Vermont. Do you have reservoirs? Do you draw from a local river? What does that source look like, and how limited are you?
We draw from the Black River, and we have a storage pond, and we have permit regulations for the height of the Black River of when we can take it out and when we can't.
Do you have enough water always for what you need, or would you like to eventually get more?
I'd say we're where we should be right now.
All right, Bruce, I want to talk about the Epic Pass here. I imagine this is one of the best benefits of joining Vail Resorts. In the Muller's final years of operating Okemo, according to New England Ski History, season passes ran as high as $1,619. The next year, when after Vail bought it, you could get an unlimited pass to Okemo, the Epic Local Pass, for $669. That was the early bird price for 2018 to 19. How much did it help that this transition in the community, that the season pass price dropped by almost $1,000? And not only did the pass price drop by that much, but you now could also take a trip out west with the pass. And I'm not sure if your Okemo pass before included Crested Butte access, but this gives you access to all those western resorts, Whistler and Park City and all the Lake Tahoe resorts and Vail, and also Stowe just right up the road. So talk about how that product was received and how big of a change that was for Okemo.
You know, Stuart, I want to thanks for bringing that up. You know, I think it's important. It's a great example of how our advanced commitment pass model works for our guests. Yeah, after our company bought Okemo, introduced the low-cost pass product, which included access to so many other resorts, and it's a great value. And it showed our community the benefits of being part of a network of resorts. It's also a reflection of our belief of inclusivity and how we welcome new people to skiing and riding, which is, you know, really central to our pricing strategy. We want to create a more inclusive environment, especially the communities that haven't been typically engaged in the sport. But we also incentivize advanced commitment with a pass purchase ahead of the winter season. It's important the stability of passes created for the industry. So pass holders, you know, they get a great deal if they commit ahead of the season. And, you know, our company gets the revenue locked in before the season starts, which, you know, gives us the confidence we need to invest back in the resorts. Think of the upgrades that come with that, like Quantum 6 and the Evergreen Summit, you know, here at Okemo. Of course, the new mobile pass and mobile lift ticket on the My Epic app debuted here at Okemo, and I think it's been, you know, running pretty well as a new product would. So after, you know, Okemo joined Epic Pass, we had so many opportunities for people to visit other resorts, like you mentioned, Attitash and Wildcat. And there's such value. And I've been hearing from longtime pass holders who were like, this is really, I've visited so many other resorts and I'm really enjoying, you know, and they're making the most of it.
Vail has done a really good job of redefining the season pass, not just for Okemo, but really for the entire industry. It used to be a very niche product, used to be for locals, and now pretty much everyone is a season pass holder. The access tiers that Okemo has settled on for Epic and Epic Local are unlimited at Okemo. And the Northeast Value Pass, which is a phenomenal deal, only blacks out major holidays. I do get a lot of emails from Okemo locals. The perception is that the mountain is more crowded, it's busier, there's more people on the hill, almost too many people at times. So I want to give you a chance to respond to that. What is the reality on the ground? Has Okemo gotten busier? And have you reconsidered those levels of Epic Pass access? And if those are the correct levels to have unlimited, for example, on Epic Local.
I do think that those are the correct levels, but I think it's important to mention that we do listen to our guests and members of the community and our staff as how can we enhance the guest experience. We do spend a lot of time reviewing and assessing which pass products make sense at which level, and it has to have a balance of accessibility and guest experience. And we're constantly talking about that, and that is something that's discussed right here at the resort level. But you know, we're also constantly managing the resort experience by investing in enhanced infrastructure efficiencies and making things better where we can. The arrival process, We have a lot of terrain and space to accommodate our guests and pass holders. And it can really make an impact is the lift terrain utilization and helping our guests navigate. I use Jackson Gore, for example. That is underutilized terrain. And I tell this to the guests all the time. You got a place to be over there. There's something for everyone. You can find moguls on Upper Limelight. You got a long blue cruiser and tuckered out. You can steep terrain, quantum leap under the lift. And then we leave Rolling Thunder natural, or you can jump into Black Hole. People do focus on the fact, like, hey, the Sunburst is busy. Yes, the Sunburst 6 is busy, but you spread out, and the others are usually not as busy as that.
So I tell you one thing about New England that I love personally, because it's not as much of a destination market as the West, tends to be pretty empty midweek, pretty much everywhere. And by empty, I mean you can ski right onto the lift or maybe wait two or three chairs at most resorts in the East on most days, from my experience. So the Epic Northeast Midweek Pass, this is an awesome product. And my perception is that there's a really strong contingent of midweek Okemo skiers who love to get up there, get that fresh core. Just talk a little bit about that product and that group and how important that's been to them just as Vail has taken over.
You know, I think it's a great option. Anyone who has flexibility to ski and ride midweek, enjoy it. It's really good. And if you can do it, I encourage it. You know, we're always looking to offer that pass product at the right price point for all the different types of skiers and riders. And we want to spread our visitation out. So, you know, the Northeast Midweek is popular with those who have the flexibility to visit in the off-peak. It's a great value.
So another tool that Vail uses to manage crowds is to limit lift tickets every day at all of its resorts. When I hosted your colleague Brian Seduhos last year on the podcast, and he runs Mount Snow, he said that they actually didn't trigger that limit at all last year, which I was kind of surprised by. I noticed that Okemo, I believe, had a sellout over President's Day weekend. But how often have you reached this limit? How helpful has this been to managing crowds at Okemo?
We don't reach it often, but we do on occasion. And yeah, it's to preserve the guest experience. It's about having a lever to manage, you know, on our most popular days without having to change the experience for our pass holders. We'll always have days that are busier than others, and it comes down to prioritizing the on-mountain experience for our guests. But by limiting lift tickets, investing in new lifts, and really spending on capital improvement, as well as enhancing our employees to having fully staffed teams, we're going to continuously here at Okemo focusing on a great guest experience. And I really feel that we do that each and every day.
So Vail has brought super cheap passes, season passes to New England. It's also brought super expensive day tickets. Peak walk-up lift tickets hit $189 at Okemo this season. I realize there's cheaper prices throughout the season, but that's the most that someone will pay. When you started back in the 80s, tickets were $32, which is actually not as cheap as it sounds. Inflation adjusted, that's $88. And obviously, the Okemo of 2024 offers a lot more to the skier than the Okemo of the 1980s. But just curious to hear your thoughts and reactions personally, Bruce, as you've watched these day ticket prices rise over the decades. Do you think that this is discouraging the growth of the sport, or do you think that products like the Epic Pass, Epic Day Pass have helped to offset this rise?
Well, we want inclusivity and we want to welcome new people to this, to skiing and riding. It's important and it's central to the strategy that we use with lift ticket pricing. As we look at pass offerings, we know that one size does not fit all, and our guests vary in what they want in a pass, which is why there's so many different options to ski and ride at our resorts, from lift tickets to our Epic Pass, which will always provide the best value. So, you know, lift tickets purchased day of will always be the most expensive. Just like if you show up in an airport, you buy a ticket on the day you want to fly. But unlike an Epic Pass product, lift tickets are fully refundable. We know some guests want that flexibility and they can save money by purchasing lift tickets online in advance. But hey, you're spot on. We think the Epic Day Pass really helps offset this. You can ski and ride for as little as one day or up to seven with an Epic Day Pass, and all you have to do is decide on a number. of days you want to visit. And when they went on sale back in March 2023, they were priced at $41 a day per day at resorts like Mount Sunapee, Adattach, and Seven Springs. Vermont and New York, Okemo and Hunter, we were priced at 66. So if you did the math on the back of a napkin like I did, it's less than inflation adjusted number you shared of $88. So I also think it's important to note, like for those that are in the Vermont, New Hampshire area, we still have the Vermont, New Hampshire Days, which is a popular ticket deal. It's on every Wednesday and Sunday non-holiday with a valid Vermont, New Hampshire license. So there's just so many ways to hit the slopes for those new and for the longtime skier and rider.
All right, Bruce, I know you got to run. I really appreciate your time, especially at the height of the season. You're an absolute legend. I really, really appreciate your time and perspective and everything you've done for Vermont skiing and Okemo. So thank you very much for joining us today. Really, really appreciate it.
And thank you. I don't know if I use the word legend, but I've been so fortunate to do what I really like. And I really appreciate your support for the industry. And I follow your podcasts and it's really great you know what you're doing. So thank you very much.
Amazing. So glad to get you on. That's Bruce Schmidt, President and General Manager of Okemo Mountain, Vermont. Bruce, that was as good as I hoped it would be. You absolutely crushed it. Thank you so, so much for that. And thank you all for listening. Lots more New England coming your way, as I have episodes already recorded with the general managers of Tenney and Gunstock. We're having a whole New Hampshire fest in 2024, actually, as Wildcat and Sunapee are on deck. Epic Pass holders, I've also got more lined up for you, as the leaders of Kirkwood and Whistler Blackcomb are scheduled to join me over the coming months. To hear those episodes as soon as they are live, please visit stormskiing.com and subscribe to the Storm Skiing newsletter. New podcasts appear in your email box several hours before syncing with the podcast services, including Apple and Spotify. There are free and paid tiers of the newsletter, and paid subscribers will receive podcasts 7 full days before everyone else. You can also follow The Storm on X and Instagram at Stormski Journal. Until next time, stay well, stay safe. I'm Stuart Winchester, and I will talk to you again very soon.
The Storm Skiing Podcast is a Quicksilver Films production.